Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it, believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of the bird brain of Alcatraz to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're looking at this week is the furtive fallacy. Yeah. Bird brain of Alcatraz. Perfect. Absolutely perfect. That's just, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, the furtive fallacy.
Yes.
This was named by a historian called David Hackett Fisher.
Right.
Who wrote a book in 1970 called Historians' Fallacies Towards a Logic of Historical Thought.
Ooh.
Which included a few different historical fallacies. This one he named the furtive fallacy, and he described it as the erroneous idea that facts of special significance are dark and dirty things, and that history itself is a story of cause mostly insidious and results mostly invidious.
Ooh, nice.
It begins with the premise that reality is a sordid secret thing, and that history happens on the back stairs a little after midnight, or else in a smoke-filled room, or a perfumed boudoir, or an executive penthouse, or somewhere in the inner sanctum of the Vatican, the Kremlin, the Reich Chancellery, or the Pentagon.
Nice.
Yeah.
On the back stairs, I like that. Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it is basically where you start your reasoning from the assumption that if an event is in some way significant, it was caused by some kind of hidden powerful
machinations going on
or cabal
behind them.
Yeah.
And not just the thing.
Not just that things happen.
Yeah. Or the thing that happened that everybody saw happening.
Yeah, absolutely. The apparent cause. No.
Yeah.
It can't be that.
No. They've gone to extraordinary lengths to make it look like that. Moon landings. Yeah. Exactly.
So there obviously there's an element of conspiracy theory in this. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Fisher acknowledged that this is often a component of conspiracy theories.
Right.
Really, he likened it to basically paranoia. Right. And that everyone has some of this right. in them, some part where they're seeing hidden things.
Yeah.
But if it gets too common and you do it too much, then it's time to call the doctor.
Right.
You don't have to necessarily go down a conspiracy theory route, but it's hard to get to a conspiracy theory without having some of this in there as well.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Because it just made me think of contrails and all of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
That there's, you know, there are things that just happen called physics or just because they do. But that's not enough. There's somewhere that, yes, and it is the fact he said, yeah, it's just basically paranoia. So we were kind of going through life going, oh my God, there are people out to get us. And then the added thing of, well, we know these things, so we aren't quite so paranoid, because being paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah, the conspiracy theorists have other aspects to their thinking. And when we did the episode Conspiracy Theory Thinking, we talked about that. That was more about the creating unfalsifiable claims that when proof is offered against them, you say, oh, well, you see, that's just more proof of the thing I think.
Yeah. So
that's another element of conspiracy theory, and this is part of it as well. This is kind of perhaps the starting point, at least, of a lot of conspiracies, is that there must be something more sinister going on, and especially where it's a kind of cognitive bias that happens when something seems significant. It's hard to ascribe mundane causes to seemingly significant events.
Yeah, yeah.
So we assume there must be some kind of significant cause behind it, and when we can't see one, we sometimes make one up.
Mm. Yes.
Trump, of course, is extremely paranoid.
Yes.
And
yes.
Always thinks that someone is out to get him, and that anything that happens that's bad for him is because some nefarious actor was doing it.
Yeah.
And our first example is, of course, about George Soros.
Yeah.
Do you ever notice the signs? Normally, in the old days, when you had a real protest, not financed by Soros or whoever might finance it, when you had a real protest where people meant it, they'd go down in their garage basement and they'd start making a sign and they'd all be there. Every sign was a perfect printed sign, green, with a perfect, beautiful post. Everything was the best money could buy. They all have the same. They were handed those signs by people. You know, at least they should make them a little different. Different lettering, different colors. But they don't. No, it's a whole big hoax going on.
So, yeah, he can't envisage that people might be protesting against things he's doing. Or against, in this case, police attacking black men and killing people. That's not possible, that people might actually rise up together with a shared desire for equity.
Yeah.
What has to be happening is that there is someone behind the scenes, like George Soros, funding these people, making it happen, handing out the signs
because, you know, because computers don't exist and printers don't exist.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if you look at a Trump rally, in fact, the very one that he's speaking in this, the signs behind him have all ironically been handed out.
All absolutely as they got, be handed to
as
the people.
They came in.
So, I mean, the thing is, yes, there are some groups that organise parts of protests where something happens on a particular day.
Yeah.
It's because someone has said, anyone who thinks this, let's get together on that day.
Yeah.
And we'll be all, in this place.
We'll all show the extent of our protest by all gathering at the same time.
So there's an element of organisation that goes into it. And for some of that, there are, you know, mass-produced signs and things. But in all of the anti-Trump protests that I've seen, there's a huge number also of just kind of bits of cardboard that people have written funny slogans on.
Exactly. Yes. And actually, if there are rallies where those are the only signs, there will be some kind of excuse for that. I can hear him saying, oh, yeah, well, you see, they're all individually making up stuff. There's no
funny
kind of cohesive...
Because he talked about this for a bit, as he does, he repeats his talking points from time to time. So he did this for a little bit. And then a little bit later, he started talking about how now that he's been talking about the signs, now you see they're not doing that. They're making their own signs to
offset that.
Yeah, to fight against his point. So, to cover up the fact that they've been organised and funded by Soros.
Yeah.
So,
got to have it. He's not one for not having it both ways, is he?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, our second example is a truth that he truthed in February of 2025. Looks like billions of dollars have been stolen at USAID and other agencies, much of it going to the fake news media as a payoff for creating good stories about the Democrats. The left-wing rag known as Politico seems to have received $8 million. Did the New York Times receive money? Who else did? So it continues a bit, and it's almost all in all caps, and there's various scare quotes. But yeah, he assumes that
billions of dollars
any money that was going from USAID to Politico that was stolen to create good stories about Democrats.
Yeah.
Because you can't just have people wanting to write good stuff. And like I challenge that there were that many good stories about Democrats. The media tends to write fairly negative stories about most people in politics. There aren't a lot of good political. How many stories do you read where it's like, this politician's great?
Yeah.
It doesn't have very much. But what happened here, of course, first of all, the number was way off.
Yeah.
The thing that he's quoting, the 8 million, was across all government agencies, that money going to Politico for subscriptions to their news service, their political news service. Because weirdly, people in politics are interested in what's going on in politics.
Yeah. And where do you go to find out about that? Yeah.
To do their job.
You go to the news, yes. It's a bit like subscribing to Bloomberg if you're in finance.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Politico has a product called Politico Pro that is specifically for political people to find out what's going on. And large numbers of people in the government had subscriptions to that paid for through their work. And so that was 8 million across the entire government. USAID, it was $44,000. So quite a lot less than 8 million.
Yeah.
But they were trying to pin it to the kind of the waste and fraud that was supposedly found under USAID. Yeah. And yeah, of course, it wasn't to create stories. It was just subscriptions like anyone would be paying for a premium news service.
Yeah.
In a particular niche.
But you can't just be that. There's got to be something much
mundane.
More furtive going on behind the scenes. And billions of dollars of marzipan filled sweet cake as at USAID. Well, yeah, you know, that must have been the European arm of that buying all of that schnollen at Christmas. Yeah.
So what an idiot. Our final Trump example is emblematic of his claims about the 2020 election.
One of your great pollsters who actually got it right, you know the gentleman I'm talking about, he said, well, Trump is going to win Pennsylvania, but you have to allow at least 5% for cheating because they cheat.
Right.
And that's in Philadelphia and various areas around Philadelphia. They cheat and they cheat like crazy. So we have him winning Pennsylvania, but you have to allow 5 points for cheating. This is a terrible thing that's happened. The mail-in ballots are a disaster. They sent millions and millions and millions of mail-in ballots. I'm sure you know people that got 2, 3, or 4, because I do, where they said, you know, we got 4 ballots. They got one at a country home. Dead people were seeing ballots. But even worse, dead people were applying to get a ballot. They were making application to get ballots. Many. And, you know, we're not talking about 10 people. We're talking, there are a lot of dead people that so-called voted in this election. But dead people were, in some cases, in many, many cases, thousands of cases, voted. But also, dead people made application to vote. They were dead 10 years, 15 years, and they actually made application. This is total fraud. And how the FBI and Department of Justice, I don't know, maybe they're involved, but how people are allowed to get away from this with this stuff is unbelievable. This election was rigged. This election was a total fraud.
Wow. It's full of everything, isn't it? It's full of all the Trump stuff, when it goes from several to many, many to thousands.
Absolutely.
Of dead people.
And this was the 9th of November 2020.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no way you could know who voted at this point.
Yeah.
The details of whether a person voted or not aren't public for months after the election. I mean, it's not true that dead people voted or people voted in dead people's names, at least not in huge numbers. There were a few cases, most of which were Trump voters, but they absolutely didn't find any evidence of this. They audited the thing to death, and there were not those people, nor were there people who were applying for votes in the names of dead people in any kind of large numbers. There also wasn't a pollster, even on Fox, who was saying, well, Trump's going to win, but, you know, drop that by 5% for fraud.
Because of cheating, Because I was thinking, oh, perhaps what Trump is characterising as margin of error, he's just calling it cheating.
Maybe,
But,
ultimately, he absolutely cannot accept that he lost the election.
No.
He doesn't understand how that could happen. So it has to be due to nefarious means. It has to, you know, maybe the FBI, Trump's own FBI and DOJ were in on it.
Were in
maybe.
On it. Yeah.
Who knows?
The people that he appointed to the DOJ, all in on it.
Yeah. And they stole it from him. It was rigged. It was stolen.
It was stolen.
Because that's a significant event. And it couldn't have possibly been because people didn't like him. There must have been some other nefarious means.
Got to have been, stuff that he made up. And even as we pointed out over 2,000 times that even with mail-in ballots, you don't know who they voted for.
Yeah, even if you could have shown that people voted in dead people's names,
yeah,
we still wouldn't know who they voted for.
No.
We only know the ones, the kind of three or four that were caught who were Trump voters. We know that we don't know that they voted for Trump. We only know that they have advocated for Trump and voted for Trump in the past and are registered Republicans.
Yeah.
And things like that. So there's assumptions you can make, but, we can't prove it.
No.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
The queen of making stuff up about what truly goes on behind the closed doors of British politics used to be Geoffrey Archer. But for our sins, this generation's keeper of the hidden truths is batshit crazy friend of the show. Not heard from her for a while. Here she is, Nadine Dorries. And so since not doing anything in her constituency and getting huffy when Boris didn't give her a peerage in his resignation honours list, she lost her seat, she's been on GB News, and she's written works of fiction, which she purports to be the truthful tellings of the shenanigans in Westminster. And so here she is in November 2023 on LBC whilst doing the rounds, plugging her book, The Plot, telling us that she has the scoop on the name of the appointee to the head of Ofcom being secretly changed.
In his red box that night, I put an advice note in which said, Prime Minister, this is the person I recommend to be head of Ofcom. What happens is the next day the Prime Minister reads that and he signs it off and it goes back into the Cabinet Office, comes back to me at DCMS and the appointment's made. Anyway, very early the following morning, very early, I got a telephone call from somebody who I will never reveal in number 10, who said to me, I think you need to know that your advice note to the Prime Minister in his red box last night was removed from his red box and it was changed. And another person's name had been put in there, and the person's name had been put in there was Stephen Gilbert.
So you would think, right, therefore, Stephen Gilbert became the head of Ofcom in
that. That's the only way that anecdote makes any sense. Sure.
Yeah. But apparently it wasn't like that, because Michael Grade was actually appointed to head of Ofcom in 2022. But stuff was happening behind the scenes. But, however, handily, she's never going to reveal the name of the caller that made that call.
Should anyone ever want to check up on it.
Yeah. That whether it actually did what she did do. Yes. So, and here she is again a year later, plugging her next book, Downfall, in November 2024 on Good Morning Britain.
The book is about the real behind-the-scenes reasons as to why Rishi Sunak called an election that he knew was going to result in the Conservative Party having massive losses.
In a nutshell, why did he?
So that would be telling you what's in the book. That would be called a plot spoiler.
Okay, fine.
But there were very strong reasons why he did it.
So that's Richard Madey there. Notice his dogged, tenacious journalistic pursuit of the truth there with, oh, yeah, okay, fine. You don't give us that bullshit. Give it. What's this revelation that you have he's called an election that he knew...
Why would the leader of the Conservative Party call an election that he knew they were going to lose?
Other than that, there could be no other reason other than there was real reasons as to why he knew that, because he knew he was going to lose. You know, apart from the fact that he'd been on the end of 14 years of absolute bollocks from the Tory party, it's hiding to nothing really, but there were strong reasons why he did it. We get somewhere nearer to them again in November 2024. This time we're on Newsnight with Victoria Derbyshire, bit of a more tenacious journalist than Richard Madeley, we're at the other end of the TV schedule in the evening. And the other end of the journalistic grilling scale.
There are people who have been working at the heart of the Conservative Party who have removed a series of prime ministers over a number of years and have created chaos in the Conservative Party, particularly over the last 4 to 5 years. And they are the same people who removed Boris Johnson, who put Rishi Sunak in place, who then tried to remove Rishi Sunak, and who were campaigning for Kemi and have now put Kemi in place.
Right. And let, so, let me pause you there, because there's a lot to unpack there.
Okay.
I mean, didn't Boris Johnson essentially remove himself? Didn't Rishi Sunak essentially remove himself with that crushing defeat in July? And didn't the Tory membership, which you say you respect, vote Kemi Badenoch in over Robert Jenrick?
So there's a lot there in terms of the history of what happened. And I've written 2 books on this now. So there are almost 300,000 pages on what happened up to the point when Boris Johnson went to Rishi Sunak coming in.
Fuck me, that's a lot of pages.
I know. Turns out it's actually 300,000 words, 200,000 of which had to be cut out. Because later on she says, oh, yeah, well, it had to be reduced to 100,000 words. Probably through lack of supporting evidence. Do you think? Yeah, because she is keen to say, with the 100,000 words, how ruthless the publisher's lawyers were in demanding she provide screenshots and other evidence to back up what she's saying. But yeah, so there's a lot of there. There's a lot there in terms of history of what happened. But despite that, like Derbyshire says, well, yeah, he did essentially remove himself by drinking himself to death in during COVID and breaking all the rules and lying to Parliament about it. And didn't Rishi Sunak essentially remove himself by calling an election that he knew he was good, that, you know, that just
apparently he
got
knew
rid of him. Apparently he knew, but we'll never find out why.
And the membership voted in Kemi. So
yeah.
But apparently, behind the scenes, someone was making all that
cabal
happen.
There's some sort of dark cabal made up of all sorts of stuff. And later on, in that same interview, she says, let me give you a quote from Dominic Cummings. And she's not got any paper in her hand or anything. And then she said, this is more or less verbatim what he said. And then kind of,
that's how you want your quotes, isn't it?
Well, exactly. If this was Jeremy Paxman, he would just fling his notes in her face and demand she walk off set. It's just,
they haven't learned by November 2024, if they haven't learned nor to have Nadine Dorries on your show.
Having had her saying exactly the same stuff a year before. Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Karma police, arrest this man. His Hitler playbook is making me feel ill, and he has crashed the party. This is what you get. This is what you get. This is what you get if you vote for Trump. We're all looking for what fallacies, what fallacies. We're all looking for what fallacies, what fallacies.
Shitter, uglier, more orangey.
Radiohead there, of course, with Karma Police.
And in the fallacy in the wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective. And our first example this week is from Cheers.
Yay!
This is the very last episode ever, the finale.
Right.
And Sam has announced that he's moving to California with Diane.
California? Riots? Smog? Earthquakes?
Oh, don't make me laugh, Don. There's no earthquakes in California.
There are?
Oh, there's never been any. See, what they tell us are earthquakes are actually sonic booms caused by a project that's been funded by the U.S. government. You see, what they're doing is they're creating a huge cavity, a tunnel, if you will, right to the center of the Earth, where they're going to build a giant computer to control the planet's rotation. Can I be the only one that's heard of this?
You know, Claire, electroshock therapy only sounds scary. Let me bring in a color brochure. It features Babar.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, Cliff,
can
I think,
be the only one that's heard this? Yeah.
Cliff got kind of progressively more conspiracy minded as the series went on. This is kind of, you know, season 11. So he's convinced that earthquakes aren't real. Or at least earthquakes in California.
Yeah.
That's just crazy.
It's a tunnel, if you will. They're creating,
Now, the thing is, even if you've seen Cheers, unless you watched the original run, this finale was in 1993, you probably haven't heard that clip before.
Right.
Because the original season finale, or series finale, was a kind of 90-minute episode, like all in one go.
Yeah.
And when it was then streamed or released on DVD and Blu-ray, it was split up into three separate episodes, and they put credits and the opening theme and stuff like that in.
Yeah.
This sequence, along with several others, was cut out. So this is the bit they didn't want you to see. So I can only assume that Cliff was right on the money with this.
Yeah.
And that's why they cut it out.
Yes.
So, yeah, a lost clip.
Wow.
So
there you go.
Our second example is from also from 1993, actually. It's from the Mike Myers film So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Right.
Not one of his worst ones.
Yeah, it's the nascent Scottish accent.
Oh, he's so fucking convinced he can do a brilliant Scottish accent, isn't he?
Well, he always was.
He never
when he was
stops.
Doing stand-up in Britain.
Yeah.
He kept shoving it in. He loves
anyway,
it.
Anyway, So in this scene, he does play a character kind of more based on him and around his age, but he also plays that character's, for some reason, Scottish father, who is a bit of a conspiracy theorist.
Well, it's a well-known fact, Sonny Jim, that there's a secret society of the five wealthiest people in the world, known as the Pentaveret, who run everything in the world, including the newspapers, and meet tri-annually at a secret country mansion in Colorado known as the Meadows.
So who's in this Pentaveret?
The Queen, the Vatican, the Gettys, the Rothschilds, and Colonel Sanders before he went tits up. Oh, I hated the Colonel with his wee beady eyes and that smug look on his face. Oh, you're gonna buy my chicken.
Dad, how can you hate the Colonel?
Because he puts an addictive chemical in his chicken that makes you crave it fortnightly, smart ass.
Two for the price of one in there.
As I said, it's not one of his worst films.
Right.
But then there is a lot to chew. I mean, The Love Guru is really fucking terrible.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's pretty bad. But the Pentaveret of
five people.
He mentions much more than one of them's the Vatican. Which
yes, exactly. And the Rothschilds. Five people. So.
Apparently they run the entire world, including all the newspapers and the media and stuff. Yeah. And one of them's Colonel Sanders.
Colonel Sanders with his beady eyes. I never thought about Colonel Sanders having beady eyes. I did go and have to look up a picture of him and go, they're quite beady.
Interestingly, Mike Myers made a TV show about conspiracy theories. Ah. The first episode of which was based on this conspiracy theory that he came up with for this film.
Excellent.
So, but obviously it's based on secret societies, Freemasons, Illuminati, Skull and Bones, those kinds of things, which a lot of people think they are powerful people who run things behind the scenes and do it for various nefarious reasons.
Yeah.
So our final example is a real world one with Randy Quaid. You may wonder why you haven't seen Randy Quaid in any films for a while, and it's definitely not because he's a shit actor and shouldn't have been in films anyway. It's because he moved to Canada with his wife to seek asylum, definitely not because he was on the run for various crimes that he and his wife were accused of, but because he was running from a group that he calls Star Whackers.
Oh, that's such a good name.
We believe there are to be a malignant tumor of Star Whackers in Hollywood. How many people do you know personally who have died suddenly and mysteriously in the past 5 years? I have personally known 8 actors, all of whom I have worked with and was close to me. Heath Ledger, Chris Penn, David Carradine among them. I believe these actors were whacked, and I believe that many others, such as Britney Spears, Lindsay Lohan, and Mel Gibson, are being played to get at their money. In the meantime, many a celebrity's image and marketability is being co-opted and destroyed. Google helps out by keeping the negative stories near the top of a celebrity's webpage because it's the negativity that brings in the advertising revenue.
Yeah, so...
Yeah.
I mean, I think the least realistic part of this is the idea that Randy Quaid would be in danger from a group attacking film stars.
Right, yes, because you've got to be a film star. I mean, surely that would be a fair, requirement.
And part of the reason why he knows so many actors is he was in 90 films.
Okay,
so
fair enough, yeah.
He met a lot of actors.
Yeah.
And some actors die sometimes. And it doesn't matter what they die of, it can always be mysterious. You know, Heath Ledger... Yeah. Had a accidental overdose. Chris Penn had a heart attack. David Carradine hung himself.
Well, erotic asphyxiation, I think, was the original.
He was found hanging in Bangkok.
Yes, and I know that because that features in a cover of a song that my band does called Bangkok. Uh-huh. And
so David Carradine. Yeah. But you know, he also, when Gene Hackman was found dead this year, Randy Quaid said, "I suspect murder," because
he
had. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Yeah.
And, you know, Gene Hackman was in his 90s. So
the Star Whackers. I mean, when was he saying this? Just after Heath Ledger died?
This was about 10 years ago-ish. I mean, he's not well, Randy Quaid. Let's be fair. He's got worse and worse and worse over time.
The inscription on his headstone will be, "See, I told you."
Yeah.
You know,
when
he eventually dies at age 104.
But the thing is, if you know a lot of people, you're going to then know people who've died because people die.
He sets it up as, there's a conspiracy of star whackers. Said, "I bet you all know people that have died suddenly." We don't all know stars.
What's the explanation for
the star whacking?
I think when he says, "How many people do you know?" he's saying, "You probably don't know anyone who's like many people. I know 8 people who've died in the last 5 years. You probably don't." That's saying. He's saying it's an unusually high number that he knows.
Right.
And therefore, the only explanation for that isn't that he knows a ton of people who many of them take a lot of drugs
and live dangerously on the edge.
Have really weird lives because they're actors.
Yeah.
It's not that. It's that someone is out to get them.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game. I understand the game as well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for fake news, the game where I read out 3 Trump quotes, 2 of which are real and 1 I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
Because what's really going on every time you hear Jim winning is what you're unable to see and thus witness, which is the sight of several large henchmen glowering silently in my close vicinity, holding precious objects dangerously high over concrete pavers or under large sledgehammers, whilst directing me to choose something other than the one Jim made up, whilst sounding genuinely uncoerced. I'm blinking twice.
Yeah, they are very good at staying off mic.
Yeah.
So we alluded to the theme actually earlier on because this is all about Alcatraz.
Yay. Yeah.
This is what happened when a reporter said, so this Alcatraz thing, what's that about?
Yeah, you idiot. Yeah.
They asked him in a press conference he was giving with Roger Goodell of the NFL.
Yeah.
What are you thinking?
Fuck.
Like, what made you come up with that idea?
Mm.
And he didn't want to say, "I saw Escape from Alcatraz on a local Palm Beach affiliate, WLRN, the night before I tweeted that." So he made something up. Not a good or logical or coherent thing, but a thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay.
Statement number one.
Right.
"It represents something very strong, very powerful in terms of law and order. Our country needs law and order. Alcatraz is, I would say, the ultimate, right? Alcatraz, Sing Sing, and Alcatraz, the movies." But it's right now a museum, believe it or not. A lot of people go there. It housed the most violent criminals in the world, and nobody ever escaped. One person almost got there, but they, as you know, the story, they found his clothing rather badly ripped up, and it was a lot of shark bites, a lot of problems.
Okay. Didn't manage to escape because of a lot of problems involving sharks. Okay. Yep.
Statement two. I think it's going to be very interesting. We'll see if we can bring it back in large form, add a lot. But I think it represents something. Right now, it's a big hulk that's sitting there rusting and rotting. Very, you look at it, it's sort of an, you saw that picture that was put out. It's sort of amazing, but it sort of represents something that's both horrible and beautiful and strong and miserable, weak. It's got a lot of qualities that are interesting, and I think they make a point.
What has he said there? Nothing at all. Okay. Yeah.
And statement number three.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a brilliant statement. You know, criminals. Everybody knows Alcatraz. The great Al Capone, Alphonse Capone. He was there. Some really tough puppies. They didn't have a good time, I can tell you. It's not a nice place. And that's what we need. Because there are really the most violent, most vicious people. And when you say we're going to send you to Alcatraz, I think they won't feel too good about that. So it's, I think, a brilliant idea, and it should have been done before.
Okay. So the one in the middle where he does, there's lots of sort ofs there, sort of. Having just read that out, I'm thinking, maybe that's something you made up. But it's a thing where he's not said anything, and that's the kind of thing he says. Okay, it's a big hulk sitting there rusting and rotting. Okay, tough puppies, is that? He gets to mention Al Capone. Okay, let's look at Alcatraz, Sing Sing and Alcatraz, the movies. Shark bites. A lot of. Okay, so on the basis of the, tough puppies. He's going to say that, isn't he? Okay, having said that, I think number three is the one you made up.
You think I made up tough puppies? Okay.
I'm being coerced right here. Somebody telling me to point at that one.
So the other two.
Oh, now he's smashed the Ming vase because I've revealed that.
So of the other two,
yeah,
which are you more convinced by?
Yeah, I think the big hulk that's sitting there rusting and rotting, number two.
Number two. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So number two.
Sort of. Yeah.
Is real.
I think it's going to be very interesting. We'll see if we can bring it back in large form, add a lot. But I think it represents something. Right now it's a big hulk that's sitting there rusting and rotting. You look at it, it's sort of, you saw that picture that was put out, it's sort of amazing. But it sort of represents something that's both horrible and beautiful and strong and miserable, weak. It's got a lot of qualities that are interesting. And I think they make a point.
It's beautiful, strong and weak and horrible and miserable and sort of amazing. It's got a lot of qualities that are interesting. And hopefully the reporter followed up and said, well, that's, you just said a whole bunch of nothing there.
Yeah.
Why the fuck are you president?
Based on that, I'm surprised he's seen a picture of it. I'm surprised that wasn't just based on someone saying, are you aware of a concept called Alcatraz?
Yes.
And he was like, not really, but I can talk about it.
Yeah. But it is. It's back to the olden days of him being asked about something he has no idea about.
Yeah,
rather than just say, well, I don't know about that, but I'll get back to you, or I can find the expert on that and then get them to write to you. He just goes on about it because he can't be seen to not know anything about anything, which he doesn't, by the way. Yeah. Oh, man.
So you also think number one is real?
Yes.
And number one?
Yeah.
It is real.
It represents something very strong, very powerful in terms of law and order. Our country needs law and order. Alcatraz is, I would say, the ultimate, right? Alcatraz, Sing Sing and Alcatraz, the movies. But it's right now a museum, believe it or not. A lot of people go there. It housed the most violent criminals in the world, and nobody ever escaped. One person almost got there, but they, as you know the story, they found his clothing rather badly ripped up. And it was a lot of shark bites, a lot of problems.
A lot of shark bites. Okay. Yeah.
You do not know that story because he just made that one up.
He just made that one up because that's not true.
That's not a thing.
Somebody
that
did escape with
an inflatable. Didn't even happen in the film.
No.
I mean,
no,
yeah. No. The movies. Arguably, the movies. There were five people in total were never found.
Right.
Three people escaped in the escape, the Clint Eastwood film. Escape from Alcatraz is based on.
Yeah.
And there's some evidence to suggest they survived,
yeah,
but it's questionable. And two people escaped several years earlier, but probably didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, weren't found. Lots of people tried. One person did manage to swim from Alcatraz to the shore of San Francisco.
Right.
But then he was captured and taken back, so he didn't technically escape, but he made the swim.
He made it, yeah.
The idea that there are sharks in the San Francisco Bay and that's a reason why Alcatraz is a good thing is kind of a myth that's put about by the guards during the time when Alcatraz was open.
Yeah.
There are types of sharks in the bay, but they are mostly small or bottom feeding sharks.
Right.
They don't bother humans. Yeah. Great whites have been spotted a few times, but there's absolutely no cases of them interacting with swimmers ever.
Right.
Swimmers regularly make the swim. Like, it's a regular thing that people do a wild swim from Alcatraz to the shore in wetsuits. Yeah. It's the thing that's hardest about it is the temperature of the water. It's very cold.
Right.
And it's like over a mile. But people do it on a regular basis. It's a fun thing that people
do. Yeah.
And
a lot of shark birds. Birds with big teeth, as Burt Lancaster used to collect them.
So, no cases of someone trying to escape and their shark-bitten shirt being found.
What is he thinking? is he thinking like sort of Papillon and
he's
Jaws?
He's just obsessed with sharks, isn't he?
Yeah. You see, you'd be safe, all right, if you had a car battery
and you could
swim, you'd be fine.
You'd be fine.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's a stupid idea to reopen Alcatraz for various reasons. First of all, they don't need to. There isn't currently a shortage of prison cells in the US.
Uh-huh.
They are below capacity.
Yep.
Alcatraz was closed in 1963 because it was ridiculously expensive to keep people there. It was more than twice as expensive, three times as expensive at the time, probably would be at least twice as expensive now.
Yep.
If it was a working prison. So you'd have to add on to that the cost of turning it back into a prison because it is currently a museum.
Part of the joy of turning it is to shut down a museum, and make another prison. That's
the fact that it's
Republican.
A museum also is a factor because it brings in $60 million a year to the San Francisco economy.
Yeah.
So that would obviously be lost and you'd have to pay the extra for keeping people there. There's just no good reasons for doing it. Probably not going to happen.
No.
It was just a thing that he came up with after watching a film. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also a distracting thing to distract us from all the other heinous things that he is doing.
Yes, it's part of the shit in flooding the zone with shit, yes.
Exactly. So, yes.
Indeed, I did make up number three.
Tough Puppies was one of yours.
Thing.
Yeah.
And I threw in the Al Capone thing because Al Capone was at Alcatraz at some point and he does like to mention Capone.
Yeah, he likes him. Yeah.
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 I'm surprised he didn't mention
Hannibal Lecter.
Hannibal Lecter. Yeah. Was that Alcatraz? That wasn't Alcatraz.
He wasn't at Alcatraz. No. We do have a few social contestants.
Right.
On Facebook,
uh-huh.
Andrew John says, two is the odd one out for not naming Alcatraz, so I think it's a true
one.
Between one and three, I think three is false. I don't know if he'd bring up Alphonse Capone again.
Yeah.
I think he would, but he didn't.
But he didn't this time. Well, it's an obvious rhyme, isn't it? Alcatraz and Al Capone.
Gregory says, three has got to be real. He'd never miss an opportunity to say that his own idea is brilliant, plus he loves Alphonse Capone.
There you go.
Yeah. I think number one might be a little on the nose, since everyone is assuming he'd actually watched the movie Escape from Alcatraz the night before. I'm pretty sure he did. So I'm guessing mentioning movies is the tell.
The fact that he laughs, he just kind of goes, the movies! Yeah.
On Patreon, Richard Thunder Hopkins says, I feel like a cheat on this one. I've heard one and two, and I've become obsessed with this goddamn freak of nature, and I'm watching every news clip released. It's making my fucking head spin. Three is fake, I hope.
Excellent.
Kaz Tui says, here we go, the tangerine toddler reacting to the latest shiny thing that just stimulated that one brain cell.
Yeah.
The last movie he saw.
Yeah.
God help us, pretty sure I've heard him blurt one and possibly two, but the Capone reference, he idolises him. Going with three is fake news.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
And Renee Z says, I've heard one and some elements of two. My concern about three is the use of brilliant twice. Brilliant is generally a British word. Jim, I'm looking at you.
Oh.
I've not heard him reference Al Capone regarding Alcatraz, which frankly surprised me. Maybe he forgot, or the movie he watched about Alcatraz that started this entire odyssey did not mention Capone. I'm choosing three as fake news.
Nice spot. Brilliant.
Yeah,
yes.
I do try to write in American English, but obviously sometimes
it slips out.
Englishism slips in. So yeah, I'll have to watch for things like that in the future. Thanks for the pointer, Renee.
Kind of, it's a large language model going on right here, isn't it? Building with But hey, despite the thick set heavies pointing at me and telling me which one to choose, I managed to get that one right. Yeah. And only lost a Ming vase, the headlight of my motorcycle, and my entire collection of Trump cards. They've been tearing them up and eating them right now. You can stop now. don't pretend you haven't
honestly,
done it.
Honestly, I don't know why you keep paying them to come round. It's weird.
Don't pretend you're not here. Just go. You can go now.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
And it's time for the part of the show that this week, at least, is called The First 100 Days Were Not a Logical Fallacy, because unbelievably, it's only just over 100 days.
So much longer.
Feels like
years.
So much longer.
Yeah.
But the kind of tradition in US politics, for some reason, we don't really do it here, do we? You don't have a first 100 days.
It kind of happens as a sort of media thing where, you know, the first 100 days of the new incoming government.
Do they delineate it like that, or do they just kind of say
Happened under Starmer.
But yeah, it's a regular thing in the US. There's a whole big thing about how have these first 100 days gone? Mm. And they do polls checking up what people think, and they kind of talk about their approval ratings and how the economy is going and all of that kind of stuff.
And military parades.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And it's not going well for Trump.
Right. There was a really angsty interview, wasn't there, with whoever it was that he professed not to have heard of, but that's okay. I've never heard of it.
ABC, it was.
That was amazing,
mostly for the fact that he absolutely insisted that picture of Kilmar Brigo Gossier's hand had MS-13 literally tattooed on it.
Yeah.
So at the time, when that picture came out, because there's a photo that was printed everywhere and kind of went around online of Trump holding up a photo of a close-up of Kilmar Brigo Gossier's hand with the tattoos on his knuckles of a marijuana leaf, a kind of smiley face with X's for eyes, a cross and a skull.
Yeah.
And someone at the White House has clumsily Microsoft painted the letters and numbers MS-13 above them to indicate that that's what they mean. The M and the S, you can kind of see because marijuana and smiley face, maybe.
Yeah,
it's not a classic smiley face.
And it wouldn't be in that in Spanish.
Yeah, it wouldn't be that in Spanish.
Yeah.
The one and the three being the the cross and the skull don't make any sense at all. No. People who know about these things, about get tattoos, say there's no particular reason why those things would mean those letters and numbers.
Yeah.
But that's the point. They were trying to make this point.
Even numerologists who know that kind of thing were going, no, that's clearly...
But at the time, people were saying, well, those letters and numbers are clearly photoshopped.
Right.
And I thought, I mean, yes, obviously they are. No one's saying he's got the letters and numbers on his knuckles.
Yeah.
That's not the point that's being made. Yes, of course they're photoshopped. That's great. No one could possibly think that the letters and numbers are actually on his knuckles.
Yeah, because that's somebody shoving on in a kind of, do you want to annotate your Snapchat, TikTok, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
Thing.
Yeah. So I was, as I very occasionally do, kind of defending the White House, the Trump administration, from what I saw as over enthusiastic shit talking.
Yes.
Because people were taking the piss out of how obviously photoshopped that was. And I was like, obviously no one thinks that. Turns out he thought it. Trump is that stupid that he thought those letters and numbers were on the guy's knuckles.
Yeah.
Because he insisted to Terry Moran, the journalist.
Yeah.
And fought back when Terry said, oh, well, no, that was Photoshop. Those they aren't on there. He was like, no, they absolutely are. You can't do this. This is really bad. You can't just lie like this, Trump
and
said.
He would not allow him to move on until he said, you've got to just say that. You've got to say that. Which there was a horrifying moment when I thought, oh, I can remember a Boris interview with somebody. There was an interviewer talking to Boris and a Labour Party candidate for something or other who was not having any of Boris's bullshit. And Boris was just like jabbing his finger at him, saying, you've got to say this, you've got to say that. And you think, oh my God, they are just petulant children who can't bear to be corrected. They've got to be right in all circumstances, or they won't permit the conversation to continue. They would just lie there on the floor of the shopping mall and bang their arms and legs on the floor until you buy them some more bloody super sour M&Ms.
Super sour M&Ms. That sounds terrible. I like sour sweets and I like M&Ms, but that...
Oh, I don't know. I think that would be brilliant.
Super sour chocolate.
Oh, an M&Ms chocolate. Oh, I'm thinking of Glees. They used to be called Glees in my youth. They were like M&Ms and you bit into them, but they were fruit all the way through.
They're not like M&Ms then at all.
No.
They're like Skittles.
Skittles, that's it. Yes, they're now called Skittles. Right, yes. Just take the word Skittles. I'm going to say Skittles in various intonations, and I want you to edit them back.
I'll do that. I definitely will do. I won't just leave this how it
Skittles,
is.
Skittles, Skittles, Skittles. Okay. Skittles, Skittles, Skittles.
That'll probably do it.
Yeah,
so he did do various interviews, but what we're mainly going to talk about really is some of the polls that have come out. The NPR PBS Marist poll asked, what grade would you give him? Like A, B, C, D, F.
Okay.
For his first 100 days.
No E. Why is there not an E?
There isn't an E. It's F. Yeah. F is a failing grade. They don't do E's in America.
Ah. Poor passes and a fail. Right. Yeah.
I'm always fascinated because they split this up into Democrats, Republicans and Independents.
Okay.
3% of Democrats gave him an A grade for the first 100 days. That is the bit.
What?
One of the things of this that always amazes me.
What? How?
What kind of Democrat is that?
This is the problem we're up against. But yes, they are always Trumpers. They're never Democrats. Never Bidens.
I don't understand a person who could self-identify, I presume. This may be registered as Democrats, but I think they're people who just identified themselves as Democrats. How could you say I'm a Democrat and also
give him an A rating?
Think that what's happened in the last 3 months is the best it could be?
Yeah.
But 3%, apparently.
Wow.
I think it's the 3% of Trump supporters who don't know what Democrats and Republicans are. Right. They are that politically unaware.
Right. Right.
That they don't understand.
Go, so are you a Democrat? Yeah, sure.
Which is the red one?
Yeah, which is... <It's> like... That's right. Yeah. And they go, yeah. Oh, is this the Democrats before they swapped or after?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Dixiecrats. That's who those people are.
Dixiecrats.
But that's weird. But anyway, as you might expect, 80% of Democrats gave him a failing grade. But overall, still 45% of people in the US who were questioned gave him an F, gave him a failing grade.
Wow, out of everybody.
Yeah, yeah. 49% of independents. So higher among independents.
Ah,
Than overall. 54% of Republicans gave him an A grade.
Ah, yeah.
Which meant that in total, 23% of Americans, A, 45% F. That's pretty bad. It's not as bad as it should be, obviously.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't deserve... any passing grade at all, obviously.
But yeah, but it just kind of shows you that it divides and all opinions in this sphere divide on political lines. What's interesting is that whilst 3% of Democrats gave them an A grade, 5% of Republicans gave them an F grade.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not nearly as surprised by.
Right.
As the Democrats, because there are Republicans who don't like Trump.
Oh, they're not kind of like Farage-type people who think that the Tories aren't Brexit enough. Are the Republicans failing him because he's not Republican enough?
I'm, if anything, a little surprised it's that low, because I think there's a number... There are quite a lot of Republicans who still consider themselves Republicans, but would never consider voting for Trump and think he's terrible for the party and he's ruined the party.
Right.
Some of those people may have been so turned off by the Republican Congress and Senate's embrace of Trumpism, they may no longer consider themselves Republican. They may now consider themselves independents or, in some cases, possibly Democrat. But people like Liz Cheney, people like Adam Kinzinger, people like the Lincoln Project people, they were all Republicans before Trump came along. I think... mostly still consider themselves to be Republicans, and if Trumpism wasn't a thing anymore, they would probably still be happy to vote for the Republican Party.
It's the equivalent here of One Nation Cameron Tories not wanting to be associated with Liz Truss or Boris Johnson.
Sure. Yeah. So a little surprised that maybe the 5% is all that represents those people. I had hoped that there would be more of those. But
what was the poll of? Was it a vast cross-section of voters?
This was 1,500 people-ish. It wasn't a huge poll. It was representative, but not massive. You can't kind of really... Like, if this was something important, you'd need more people.
Yeah. They just went around the office building, didn't they, at NPR. Being a broad church, they just kind of went, they employ everybody, because that's what DEI means to them. We'll employ Republicans as well as Democrats. Yeah.
I mean, with that number, your margin of error is plus or minus 3 1/3 percentage points.
Oh, okay. So the number of Republicans that fail him could be 8%.
It could be as high as 8%, yes.
Yeah.
Arguably.
Yeah.
So, overall, his approval rating
for
just generally doing the job, people who approve or strongly approve, is 42%, which is incredibly low. In the last 80 years of polls taken at the 100-day mark, only one president has polled lower his approval rating.
Than
42%.
Right. And do we have to go back far for that?
No, that was just a couple of presidents. That was Trump in his first term.
Who scored lower than himself. 42%. Fantastic.
Only just.
Yeah.
I think he was 41% last time. So.
and then he followed a Democrat.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's doing pretty badly in that respect.
Wow.
They questioned whether people approve on various different specific things.
Yeah.
Immigration.
Yeah.
87% of Republicans approve of the job he's doing on immigration.
Of course they do, because they're all racists.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Is he actually doing things on immigration?
Well, I mean,
he's shipping.
He's deported people to El Salvador with no due process.
Yeah.
Apparently, 87% of Republicans love that.
They love that. Yeah. That's nothing to do with immigration. That's just vindictiveness. Yeah.
But overall, it is 44% approve, which is 37% of independents and 11% of Democrats. Still, I can't understand why 11% of Democrats think he's doing a good job on immigration. I guess there's racist Democrats as well, aren't there? That's well, the fair thing.
Yeah.
Is there are Democrats who aren't actually, you know, necessarily socially liberal.
If it's the same Dixiecrats.
There's going to be some of them built in, yes.
Yeah.
The reality is it's not really a significantly left-wing party. It's a centrist party. So there's definitely Democrats who think they should get rid of brown people.
On that end of the centrist.
Yeah. I mean, let's face it. There weren't enough Democrats to vote for Kamala Harris. So.
There you go.
You know.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's the thing we're dealing with. Yeah. Foreign policy, a bit worse than immigration. 81% of Republicans approve, 7% of Democrats approve. 35% of independents, so overall 39%. It's very similar numbers to those on how well he's doing with the economy, which, I mean, Jesus Christ. The fact that foreign policy and the economy are the same.
Yeah. Has he got a foreign policy? Is his foreign policy tied up with the tariffs and is the economy tied up at the same time?
I would say that his foreign policy and the economy are both the tariffs.
Right.
If not for the fact that they asked about the tariffs separately and only 73% of Republicans think he's doing a good job with the tariffs.
Oh, what?
But otherwise, Democrats and independents, roughly the same. But there's at least 8% of Republicans who don't approve of the tariffs, but do think, despite the tariffs, he's doing a good job with foreign policy and the economy, which
is
mind-blowing.
Yeah, it doesn't compute. How are they extracting the concepts of foreign policy and economy separate from the tariffs? Where is foreign policy happening? Oh, maybe that's Greenland and Canada.
Could be Greenland.
Canada. Is that Greenland?
I assume those 8% of Republicans reckon he's doing really well stopping the Russia-Ukraine war, maybe?
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
He's done such a great job on day one.
On day one. Aren't they kind of saying, we're not going to be able to solve that now?
He said now, for some reason, he's come to the conclusion that he's not sure Putin wants to stop fighting. Nobody could have possibly thought that before. He's taken 3 months to come to that.
Yeah, yeah.
It does make sense now, though, now that that's what he's discovered, why he thought it would be so easy to stop it.
If he didn't know that
before,
he thought
Putin wanted to stop fighting.
Yeah, he was just being forced. His hand was being forced. Yeah. He didn't like it.
In which case, it would be easy to stop.
Yeah. He's not a vindictive guy.
All you'd need to do is call him up and go, it's all right, you can stop.
You could just stop.
Don't worry about it. You could just let it go. No one will think any worse of you.
No one's looking. Yeah. It's fine.
But he doesn't want to, everybody's so rooting nothing for can you be done.
Do that. No.
Yeah. I guess what's happening is that Republicans are listening to what Trump is saying is happening rather than what's actually happening. Because I think, because like the economy thing, all of the stuff that he claims is happening with the economy, that it's going to be boom times and the egg prices and the gas prices are down and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
If you don't interact with the economy, but only listen to what Trump says about it, you would think he's doing a good job.
Yeah. The 5-year plans are all going swimmingly. Yeah. So if you listen to the Politburo.
If you have shares, a 401k, a salary, a mortgage,
a need to access healthcare,
then you'd know how shit it is.
Yes.
Basically, generally, he's underwater on everything. There isn't a single thing, a single aspect of his presidency that people think he's doing a good job on as a majority.
Yeah.
51% of people think that Trump has put the country on the wrong path.
Okay.
49% think that his policies have negatively impacted them specifically. That's almost exactly half the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's not true to say that half the country are Democrats and half are Republicans.
No, it's roughly third each. Third Democrats, third Independents, third Republicans.
So for it to affect a half.
Yeah. On the future of the economy, so not how it's gone so far, but how people think it's going to go. Consumer confidence is at the lowest it's been for a very, very long time. Basically, since March of 2020 was the last time it was this low.
Oh, my God.
And I think there was a big thing that was happening around that period of time that meant that people would think the economy wasn't going to do very well for a little while.
Yeah. Wasn't it the reintroduction of cassette tapes or something?
Probably something like that. Yeah. I can't remember exactly. Yeah. It was a big deal at the time, but we've moved on. So, people don't think things are going to be good for a little while. 64% of Americans think that grocery prices will increase from where we are now. Yeah,
they will, yes.
They will, absolutely.
Not least because of the 10% tariff across the board. It means that basically it's a tax hike for everybody. What do people think about tariffs?
Well, they're not largely very happy about it.
Okay, yeah.
57% think that they'll hurt the economy, which is accurate. Two-thirds of Republicans... However, I think they'll help.
Oh, okay. They're listening to Trump rather than having to afford new phones or anything.
There was another poll that was done by the Public Religion Research Institute.
Right.
Which was a bit bigger, 5,000 adults.
Yeah.
52% of people saw him as a dangerous dictator whose power should be limited before he destroys American democracy.
Wow.
It's a little more than half.
Wow.
That's it's quite bad.
What's interesting is that 48% didn't think he was a dangerous dictator whose powers ought to be.
Well, 44% said they saw Trump as a strong leader who should be given the power he needs to restore America's greatness.
The follow-up question is, when was America's greatness? What year was that? What were they doing? and how do we restore that? And who stands to benefit from that happening? Only when we get answers to these questions will we permit him to carry on with it.
61% of people in the PBS poll said that he is moving too fast, basically rushing to make changes.
Yeah, slow down. You're going too fast. Yeah.
And 85%
bloody hell
of Americans think that he should follow court orders even if he doesn't like them.
Well, that's encouraging.
It is a high number. It's not nearly enough still.
No, because that means that 15-odd% say, fuck it, whatever.
Only a quarter of Republicans think that he should follow court orders even if he doesn't like them.
Wow. That's because they're just enjoying the freedom of being able to do what the fuck they like.
Party of law and order. That's what they are.
Well, yeah.
He has moved some things in a positive direction, poll-wise.
Okay, yeah.
Mostly things he's against. Like, for example...
Right.
The Liberals in Canada, who voted overwhelmingly for Mark Carney as their leader.
There is that, yes. And actually in Australia.
Yeah,
Cited the
I think, the Trump yeah, effect. I mean, that absolutely it was part,
the influx
partly
of the socialists.
Helpful.
Yeah.
But yeah, in Canada, the Liberals were down by more than 25 points when Trump was inaugurated.
Yeah.
So to be unpopular enough to lose an election in another country... It's quite impressive.
Yeah. He should slap a tariff on that, really.
Yeah. Things that he is against.
Yeah.
Because he's so shit and unpopular.
Yeah.
Have seen an uptick in people being in favour of them.
Right. Yeah.
Chicago Council on Global Affairs asked people if they think that the US should pursue a policy of global free trade. Like trading with other countries, is that a good thing? Basically.
Yep.
In June 2024, 35% of Americans thought, global trade, good thing.
Yeah.
It's quite low. Now, 55% of people, after all of the tariff bullshit.
Wow.
So people are supporting free trade. Foreign trade specifically, this is a Gallup poll. Is foreign trade an opportunity for economic growth? Mm-hmm. Went from 61% to 81% during Trump's first 3 months. 81% of Americans now see foreign trade as an opportunity for economic growth, not as other countries stealing from us, as Trump sees it. Now only 14% of Americans see it as a threat to the economy, down
from
almost
30%. I think most of those are employed
30%.
By the Republican Party.
Yeah.
That 14%, you can kind of count those on the finger of one finger. Yeah.
Also, immigration is becoming a lot more popular under Trump.
Despite all his heinous efforts at flinging people out without due process.
Yeah. So
wow.
October 2024, an Economist YouGov poll asked US adult citizens if, in general, immigration makes the US better off.
Right.
35% of people thought it did. Now that's gone up to 40%.
Wow.
36% thought it made America worse off, and that's gone down to 29%.
Oh, wow.
It's fairly uniform. Things that he's in favour of have become less popular, and things that he's against have become more popular. I'd say that the reaction of Americans to Trump's first 100 days has not been uniformly positive.
Yeah.
Largely because it's been shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think that's the reason.
And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
A special report in The Economist in October 2024, a month before the election, called America's economy the envy of the world and said America had left other rich countries in the dust. Biden brought inflation down from 9% in June 2022 to just 2.4% by the election and presided over 48 consecutive months of job growth, a record high stock market, and the highest growth in GDP since Carter. Naturally, Trump took credit for much of that, claiming that investors were just excited at the prospect that he would be elected. Curiously, now that the numbers are in for Trump's first 3 months, he's a bit happier to share the responsibility around. The US economy shrank by 0.3% since January. The stock market still hasn't recovered from the whole tariff shitstorm, and Goldman Sachs raised the probability of recession in the next 12 months to 45%, up a bit from 15% at the end of Biden's term. Trump opened his cabinet meeting last week by saying, "You probably saw some numbers today, and I have to start off by saying that's Biden, that's not Trump, because we came in January." And it doesn't seem like he's super confident about the next few months, because he closed it by saying, "You can even say the next quarter is sort of Biden, because it doesn't just happen on a daily or an hourly basis, but we're turning it around. It's a big ship to turn around."
Yeah.
The big ship metaphor for the US economy is a good one. It's one I've used before. But the problem is that Trump has, through a combination of incompetence and ego, demonstrably managed to turn that ship from a course headed for tropical islands and kittens right into a waterfall in the Bermuda Triangle. Trump isn't completely washing his hands of any blame, of course. He does take responsibility for some aspects of the economy. When asked by Kristen Welker on NBC, he said, "I think the good parts of the Trump economy and the bad parts of the Biden economy, because he's done a terrible job." And in a way, he's right, because the good parts are things he's completely made up, like eggs for under a dollar and gas for $1.98. In fact, average gas prices in the US today are $3.145 per gallon, up 2 cents from the average on Inauguration Day, which is actually kind of impressive since gas prices are down globally due to a drop in the price of crude oil. In the UK, prices have dropped the equivalent of 20 cents per gallon since January 20th. And in case you'd like to feel like the economy could be worse, our average gas price this week is £1.33 per litre, which is $6.70 a gallon.
Yeah. A lot of that is duty.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is spent on our really good quality roads.
Yes. Yeah. As is our road tax, which we all pay per car owner.
No potholes in British roads. No.
For 3 days this week, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt invited MAGA-friendly influencers to ask her questions during a dedicated press briefing. Tens of millions of Americans are now turning to social media and independent media outlets to consume their news, and we are embracing that change, not ignoring it, Leavitt said in a 7-minute opening speech. Well, that's one in the eye of the traditional media, isn't it? Too often, legacy outlets focus on fripperies such as, "But the Supreme Court has ordered you to do this, so why haven't you done it?" or "Why is there a tariff on an uninhabited island?" or "Come on, that's clearly Photoshop." Instead, they ought to address the biggest issue of the day. "My Uber drivers finally speak English again, so thank you for that," as noted by the first influencer to ask a question, Erin Wexler. The new media briefing is part of the Trump administration's attempt to formalize a network of friendly commentators and influencers who have prospered on X and YouTube and Rumble and podcasts and ultra-conservative television channels. The plan appears to be to secure the loyalty of these attention-hungry narcissists by setting them against one another in a kind of sycophancy Hunger Games as they compete for access through ever greater acts of devotion and flattery. Jack Posobiec, best known for promoting the Pizzagate conspiracy theory, asked a minute-long question about how violent the far left was and received a two-minute-long answer from Leave It about how violent the far left was. And viewers also heard from Dom Lucre, who describes himself to his 1.5 million ex-followers as a breaker of narratives, asking if the White House would investigate Barack Hussein Obama and Hillary Rodham Clinton for election integrity offences. It's refreshing to actually hear a question on election integrity because the legacy media would never ask such a question, Leave It replied, ignoring the fact that the media asked quite a lot of questions about her boss's well-documented iffy election integrity efforts to pressure officials in Georgia to declare him the winner there in 2020. They're so out of touch with where the American people are on this issue. The first briefing lasted 25 minutes, although the barrage of safe questions and safe answers made it feel much longer. The obvious knock is that this is not journalism, but entertainment. Trouble is, it's not even particularly entertaining. Of course, it's all about quid pro quo. Influencers are offered access to all the awesome scenery of the White House, the perfect backdrop for any viral video, and the heady sense of being insiders. In return, all they have to do is ask questions that will make a Soviet propagandist blush and provide the coverage the great leader so desperately crazed from fellow empty-headed, preening, self-important nobodies.
You may recall that some Republicans took an interest in whether Joe Biden's son Hunter sought to enrich himself through his connection to the president, and they were pretty sure that he did, and it was bad. With that fresh in everyone's mind, I'm sure they would be paying close attention to Donald's kids to make sure they're squeaky clean. Weirdly, though, I haven't heard any of them mention Don Jr.'s latest venture. He's one of the owners of an exclusive invitation-only Washington, D.C. club that costs more than $500,000 to join. Other owners are Zach and Alex Witkoff, the sons of Steve Witkoff, Trump's special envoy to the Middle East, and Omid Malik, a Trump mega-donor. Still, nothing wrong with that. Don Jr. mixes in D.C. circles these days, so he's bound to meet and work with people tangentially related to politics. It's not like he's trading on his dad's position to make money with this club, which incidentally is called Executive Branch and caters to businesses and tech moguls who are looking to nurture their relationships with the Trump administration, according to two people who spoke to Politico about it. They also said that the referral requirements and prohibitive pricing is meant to ensure the C-suite crowd can mingle with Trump advisors and cabinet members without the prying eyes of the press and wannabe insiders. Even James Comer couldn't fuck up this investigation. They're doing it all out in the open.
Trump, who of course knows everything there is to know about the media industry, is either upset because Hollywood didn't vote for him, or he just thinks that foreign film production constitutes a national security threat. Whilst this may not withstand legal scrutiny, it does seem to form the basis of his wish to impose a 100% tariff on movies produced outside the United States. How on earth this will be implemented is not clear, but many in the industry are certain that it would have the ability to bring the movie business to a standstill, which is the last thing Hollywood needs after dual strikes and a content recession. Jay Shures, a vice chairman of United Talent Agency, told CNN, "The fact is, it's cheaper for Hollywood studios to pay for everyone to get into planes too and pay for hotels overseas because of the cost of labor and lack of rebates in the US. Incidentally, as intellectual property, movies are a form of services and not goods. Services are not ordinarily subject to tariffs, and it's unclear how Trump's tariffs on foreign movies would work." On Monday, a White House spokesman, Kush Desai, said while no final decisions on foreign film tariffs have been made, the administration is exploring all options to deliver on President Trump's directive to safeguard our country's national and economic security while making Hollywood great again. And of course, this is all because other nations have been stealing the movies, the movie-making capabilities from the United States, said Trump, apparently referring to the growing number of movies that are produced in other countries like Canada. "We should have a tariff on movies that come in. Will historical dramas about the US involvement in World War II be taxed for filming in the places where they're set?" As Shores asked, if 2 minutes of the movie is shot overseas, does that deserve to be taxed? Where is Italian Job 2 supposed to be shot? I suspect it's all because Trump never had a part in a film where he got to fly to an exotic location because he's shit. Never mind trying to be the Pope, mate. You couldn't pass the audition for the role of the policeman in Death in Paradise.
The Oval Office, seen in footage from the White House itself, but also well known to viewers of The West Wing, Mars Attacks, White House Down, and of course Wonder Woman 1984, along with hundreds of other TV shows and movies. Part of what makes it so iconic is the reverence people hold for the history that's happened in that room. Pivotal decisions taken by great men who felt the weight of responsibility and service to the people they represented. The room has become a legendary symbol of America in the same vein as the Stars and Stripes or the Bald Eagle. So naturally, Trump is doing his best to fuck it up. Trump, of course, sees no value in history, so he's slowly covering his office in gold. Gold ornaments crowding every shelf, gold cups in recesses above windows, a gold paperweight with his name on it, lest he forget, on the Resolute desk. Gold framed paintings on every wall and gold appliques on every fucking surface, from fireplaces to fascias, cornices to wainscoting. He claims it's 24-karat gold, but exact copies of some elements were found on Alibaba in polyurethane foam for a couple of dollars. And this gilded and shitified office is where he sits to decide how many dolls American children are allowed, because his inshitification of the economy means they can't have the usual 37, apparently, but must settle for 3 or 4.
Fantastic.
Have you seen the pictures of the gold fucking office?
It is the polyurethane.
Every week there's
things.
More gold. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Eventually, he'll do away with the chair, that kind of big old leather kind of
armchair.
That'll
be a throne. It'll be like the Taskmaster throne.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Beginning in the 2025-26 school year, thousands of high school students in Oklahoma will follow a new curriculum, which includes a section that requires students to analyze contemporary turning points of 21st century American society. But it's not so much a course on conspiracy theories, but an official component of the new social studies curriculum created by Oklahoma Superintendent of Public Instruction, Ryan Walters. He's a Republican, of course, that requires students to identify discrepancies in 2020 election results by looking at graphs and other information, including the sudden halting of ballot counting in select cities in key battleground states, the security risks of mail-in balloting, sudden batch dumps, an unforeseen record number of voters, and the unprecedented contradiction of bellwether county trends. In March, Walters said, in something akin to a missive from the 1984 fiction novel's Ministry of Truth, the purpose of this section was to teach students to think for themselves and not to be spoon-fed left-wing propaganda. According to Walters, there are legitimate concerns about the integrity of the 2020 election that were raised by millions of Americans in 2020. No. They weren't legitimate, as attested in every case brought to court by Trump and his lackeys about sudden halting of ballot counting in select cities in key battleground states, the security risk of mail-in balloting, sudden batch dumps in an unforeseen record number of voters, and the unprecedented contradiction of bellwether county trends being thrown out and ruled as illegitimate. But hey, never mind, the new curriculum will only cost Oklahoma taxpayers around $33 million, and Mums for Liberty praised it as being truth-filled, anti-woke, and unapologetically conservative, and not spoon-feeding right-wing propaganda at all. They also delivered a warning. In the last few election cycles, grassroots conservative organizations have flipped seats across Oklahoma by holding weak Republicans accountable. If you choose to side with the liberal media and make backroom deals with Democrats to block conservative reform, you will be next. So, no wonder Walters also proudly announced that his new curriculum will increase the number of mentions of the Bible from 2 to nearly 50 for students starting in first grade. The Bible lessons primarily focus on the influence of Christian values on the Constitution and the Founding Fathers. Of course, the curriculum does not reference the Founding Fathers' insistence on the separation of church and state since the 1600s. Oh, no. Walters and many of the Christian nationalist figures who helped him craft the curriculum have said that the separation of church and state is unconstitutional or a myth, not dissimilar in many ways to the unconstitutional 2020 stolen election big myth. And hey, who wants Mums for Liberty coming round and holding you to account for being weak and turning the other cheek or forgiving trespassers and other similarly pussy-ass stuff? Jesus Christ!
If we have any Oklahoma listeners who have high school-age children,
yeah,
can I recommend a book?
Schooling them elsewhere?
There's a great book called 2,000 Mules and One Big Lie.
Where
your kids could learn about all of that stuff in actual context with real facts and citations.
And not be spoon-fed right-wing propaganda.
It would give them some great things to bring up to their teachers.
It would. It makes them think for themselves, certainly. Yeah.
Back in November, we talked about Trump's insane cabinet picks, and I mentioned that his pick for Surgeon General, Jeanette Nishwat, might not last, because while she was a regular on Fox, she'd also advocated for mask and vaccine mandates, and some of Trump's base weren't happy about that. Well, that finally came true last week when she was booted before ever being confirmed, although it's not clear whether she was got rid of because she unwisely promoted responsible health practices or because she got her medical degree in the Caribbean before doing her residency in Arkansas, which is a totally legitimate pathway. Mm-hmm. Anywho, Trump has replaced her with someone who I'm sure will be great. Oh, no, sorry. It's a right-wing wellness influencer who never finished her residency and doesn't have a medical license. For Surgeon General. Well, fuck. She's anti-vaccine, anti-birth control, pro-raw milk and talking to trees to get romance advice. For some right-wing nutjobs, at least, she's not crazy enough. Mike Adams, the health ranger, said she's not a health freedom advocate. She'll never recommend natural cancer cures or remedies. She's basically cosplaying as a Maha champion. That's Make America Healthy Again, by the way.
Okay.
RFK's former running mate, Nicole Shanahan, former national security advisor Mike Flynn, and all-round crazy person Laura Loomer have all spoken out against memes, saying Trump has made a bad choice because they think she's too mainstream.
Oh.
Meanwhile, Trump, when asked why he would pick a Surgeon General without a medical license, said, "Because Barbie thought she was fantastic. I don't know her."
Wow. That's his usual thing. He said, I know nothing about that.
I've never met her. I don't know who you're talking about. No. Casey who?
In Britain, we've had local council elections, basically the chance at a local level to elect who you think would represent your community's interests vis-a-vis managing the budget funded by people paying their community charge, how best to manage bin collecting, how could local transport better encourage people to not use their cars in towns, should we have Christmas decorations in the shopping centre again this year, that kind of thing. Nah, of course it isn't. It's a way for the national parties to bash the incumbent government and poke them in the collective eye with a sharp ballot paper. It's always touted as an effective measure of opinion about the progress the national government is making. Needless to say, Labour didn't do too well, sort of coming nationally about fourth. Nigel Farage's Reform Party, Farage defined as a jumble or medley of disorganised, haphazard or even nonsensical ideas or elements, took a lot of votes, positioning themselves as an alternative to both the Tories and Labour, and got voted into running a lot of councils. Former Conservative Dame Andrea Jenkins even became Reform Mayor of Greater Lincolnshire, and in the by-election in Runcorn and Helsby, Reform won a new MP, taking the post from Labour by 6 votes. The problem for Reform is that they're now going to have to actually run some local councils. As basically a protest party and Farage's private company for sticking 2 fingers up at the establishment and getting on television to spout its thinly veiled racist views, they have no experience whatsoever being in local communities, let alone managing budgets on behalf of the community members. Indeed, Desmond Clark, Reform UK councillor, has already stepped down a matter of days after being elected to Nottinghamshire County Council. Having run an election on a promise to cut spending and waste, his resignation will trigger a by-election costing taxpayers thousands of pounds. Meanwhile, whilst everyone slavers over the threat that Reform poses with its winning of 677 seats, the Green Party won 43 and now have 859 seats. The Tories lost 674, and the Liberal Democrats now control more councils than the Conservatives for the first time ever. Oh, and Labour lost 187. Basically, Labour not being Labour enough, and the Tories not being reform enough, and Farage promising everything to everybody resulted in the Tories possibly considering letting Farage be their Prime Minister at some point if they want to survive what's looking like the end of the two-party system. And having only ever been it for themselves since their founding in 1834, the Tory party will find sufficient words to justify that to themselves way before letting Boris anywhere near the job again.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this week. You'll find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com. And if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Or simply tell one other person in person about how much they'd like our podcast. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump, just like our strawman level patron Chuck Gray, Mike Smith, LT, Colleen Layla, Richard Thunder Hopkins, Will M, Scott, Mark Rykin, Amber R. Buchanan, who told us when we met her at QED we could call her Amber, and last year at QED I met the listener, recognised her at QED the year before because we keep using her full name all the time. And our true Scotsman level patrons, Renee Z, Melissa Sitek, Stephen Bickle, Janet Uetta, Andrew Houck, and our top patron, Kaz Tui. Thank you so much for your patronage, everybody. It's really very, very much appreciated.
And you can connect with those awesome people as well as us and other listeners in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallacioustrump or in the Discord at fallacioustrump.com/discord.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.